and noticed how they were kind of waving around as they tend to do. And it reminded me of a dream I'd had a couple of weeks before, and that's where I want to start. It was a dream about a snake. We have a wonderful snake neighbor on Sparks, in the house I'm in, that comes back and forth. I'm sure it probably has a good-sized territory, but in particular there's a nice culvert pipe that joins two properties. It goes back and forth there. He or she is about 4 or 5 feet long. It's a gopher snake. Really beautiful brown blotches along the back, and I've seen it a number of times. I've admired it. A little head on this very muscular body, and I imagine how it feels. I haven't touched a snake in a long time, although in the past I have. Michael Fawcett had me petting snakes at one point at Regal Road. So they're a very vital, self-contained energy. And that's the one in my dream, that snake. So in the dream, starts out with him curled up, kind of squished, compressed under indoors in sort of a living room under an aquarium. I kind of really, maybe even trapped, kind of squished and wrapped up in there. And it's not a good place for him. Doesn't fit. Doesn't belong there. And I admire him from a distance. I'm a little nervous of his bite because when Michael Fawcett picked up the snake that was, I think it was a gopher snake at my place in Regal one time, it bit him. Well, it wasn't poisonous, but it did bite. So I was admiring the snake from a distance in the dream. And someone who was with me and was more confident reached out and she got the snake from behind the head where it couldn't reach around to bite. And picked it up, and it wrapped its body around her arm, her free arm, several times. And then she carefully, sort of gingerly, walked outside with the snake and went down toward the ground, and the snake slithered off her arm quite happily. And then a little bit later, I saw the snake drinking from a little pool of water outside. I realized, it had gotten stuck in the wrong place because it was thirsty. It wanted a drink from that aquarium. And outside, there it was with its head up, drinking from this little natural pool of water. And maybe a couple of days later, I was remembering the dream because it had stayed with me. It had been very vivid and very enjoyable dream. I was lying down. I was lying, I guess, in bed. And I became the snake because I wasn't, wandering around on my little legs, doing. I was lying down. I felt myself become the snake, and this as a snake, completely contained, without a need for hands, let alone feet. But without a need, and this in the dream, it was the snake doesn't need hands, and it was a feeling of great freedom, which surprised me. Here I am loving hands, but it was complete release into freedom. And that experience of being in this wonderful muscular snake body that felt just the same way from the inside as it feels from the outside is for the snake. The way the snake moves with complete confidence, as it seems to me, looking at it from the outside generally, but this as when I was a snake, I felt quite confident too. But moves with confidence, with presence, fully present, just as it is, moving along without any need to do anything in the way of a hand kind of a activity. No grasping and moving and manipulating. Maybe no manipulation. It's a wonderful feeling. Much as I love hands, and I was an artist before this, I was a craftsperson, there's the computer, there's so much with hands. It was so interesting to feel completely free, released from something in the no hands. No effort was what I felt. There was no effort. Because started thinking more about hands. Now they are such an agent of our life. They're sort of a medium, almost, an agent of our mind. they do, they work, they reach, and that's their genius and their demon, both. And that I hadn't seen the demonic or dark, shall we say, side, shadow side of hands that deeply until I was released into this snake body from having them. It was a freedom from effort, from human effort, from efforting. And such a relief, a relaxation and a rest. But hands are native to the human body. I'm not a snake, except for a moment lying down. So I'm not a snake, I'm a person with hands. And of course I knew how hands can harm and hit and destroy or drop. I know how they work and they get lost and they get numb and they get caught up in busyness and then they reinforce busyness. Endlessly caught up in busyness. If they have to do very repetitive things, the whole person gets numbed. Just the hands that have to work on a assembly line in the south cleaning chickens. I'm reading an article about what it's like to work in one of the towns where they have those huge factory farms of chickens with big companies, where the young women in their 20s are there with conveyor belts working with wet, cold water, pulling apart chickens, and you have to do one every 30 seconds or so. In 5 years, their hands are basically destroyed. And before that, they're doing this mind-numbing work until the hands are so numb. So there's a numbing. If the hands can be caught up in this endlessly repetitive things that are really numbing to the hands and to the person. And they speak. Hands do. You know, they wave. They express all kinds of things. Some things that I didn't understand when I was in elementary school in New York City, where all sorts of gestures happening. They make mudras, you know, the wonderful Buddha mudras that express a great deal. All the different kinds of sign languages. And hands connect. They stroke. They touch. A tremendous number of nerve endings there. They engage. They become then not just a vehicle of intimacy, but an expression, the means, the mode even of intimacy. So hands do. Hands are forever doing. And most especially, that one of the things they do most is reach. They reach out to the world. They reach out in the effort to work. They grab. They cling. Which comes first, the hand or the eye, the thumb or the brain? You know, evolutionary biologists used to argue endlessly, or physical anthropologists did, which came first, which spurred evolution, human evolution more, the opposable thumb leading to the expanded brain or the expanded brain leading to the opposable thumb. It's kind of a chicken and egg thing. But they definitely spurred each other on, shall we say, each encouraging the other, because the opposable thumb can do so much more. That's why I could have a skunk instead of a raccoon would have been horrible to have in a house for a long time, because they have these semi-opposable thumb and they get into such mischief and they're so destructive. But a skunk doesn't have an opposable thumb and is a lot more benign in its activities. Yeah, chop off our thumbs, right? It would be a lot more benign. No, it doesn't work, because we're humans. But so this opposable thumb encourages the brain and the mind into all kinds of places. And then the mind encourages this thumb to do things. Hands work so hard, you know. They feed us, they clothe us, they work to put a roof over our heads, either literally or figuratively. They work to make sense of the world, to figure it out. They work to bring the world to us. This is very difficult to fulfill your humanness without them. They translate the world through touch. Thinking about touching a person and touching a person are very different, right? Very different kinds of experiences. They both are experiences, thinking about something is an experience in itself. But it's a very different kind from the actual, from the touch. They create. So in many ways, hands are like words. And we study words more in our practice because the words are the medium of the mind, and we hardly know a mind without words. And the words, the ideas turned into words, are how we see our ideas for the most part. We don't really see or even have maybe a concept or idea without a word. So they're pretty tightly meshed in there. And words are exquisite. You know, they're refined, they're subtle, very subtly differentiated. We talk about no discrimination, but words are made out of differentiation, and there would be no sense and meaning without those differentiations. We're not trying to live in a world without differentiation. That would be meaningless. Words are natural expressions of humanness. So maybe words and the thumb evolved together. And words divide, and they delude, and they harm. And that's the kind of thing, one of the kinds of things we come to see in our Zen practice, in Zazen. We see how, in themselves, the word is just sounds. And then representations and opinions and poems, communiques. But the mind that creates these strings of sounds shaped into words, turns around and believes in them as solid things, and turns them into boxes and labels. The hand doesn't do that as much as our words, our mind does. And this is an unfortunate natural quality of the mind. It's not something we're ever going to get rid of or get beyond. It turns out that the mind just naturally does this kind of reifying, this turning things into solid things. This is just the way, you know, when people started studying memory and false memory, implanted memory, that we, in the sense that if we experience a story enough, it will become real to us, and in our brain it will be indistinguishable from a personally had experience, and if it becomes colorful enough to us, we will have other sensory experiences of it, and then it's our memory, by good might. And then of course it changes every time it comes up, so this is all changing and happening, but the brain does this, and the brain does say word starts at this syllable and ends at this syllable. The concept behind it starts here and ends here. Blue starts on the spectrum here and ends here. Starts differently in different places. The Japanese use one word for most of what we call blue and green. You know? Those are the easy ones to see, but it's true of all of our words. Our words, in this way, naturally have to differentiate one aspect of the world around us from another, but then we believe that that is more true, more solidly, unchangingly true than it could possibly be. And so we create boxes and labels and slings and arrows, weapons, walls, with our words. I think because hands are more visceral, more physical, and they move through space differently, they have some of the same qualities of words and some very different qualities. And yet the same question comes up, even though there's a real difference in this kind of, so we say, grounded or physical quality what the hand does and knows. Hands have this dark side too, and we need to know that, and can we enjoy the genius of the hand without the dark side, which for me was I saw more clearly in the experience of effort, of being released from efforting. Not that we shouldn't make efforts, of course we make efforts, but the quality of efforting as a background constant experience that we're not so aware of is in a way like the background quality of words and ideas that we find it hard to pay attention to their quality as words and ideas and say, oh yes, that's real, it's an idea, but it's not who I am, who you are. It's not a, a, a true, complete fact of what's happening. It's a description. We can learn to see that in Zazen about our ideas. How do we? Where do we see that with the hands? The unconscious assumptions of the hand, of efforting. And I think when I thought that, I thought, well, you know, I don't really see the genius of the hand very clearly either. I take it for granted. I just, you know, wave them around, pick something up. If you watch a young child trying to get control of these things, you get a lot more respect for the hand. And I broke my good left hand, the good hand, very badly many, many years ago. And it was in a cast for months like this. And so I learned to use my right hand. And, you know, lefties do use their right hands. So I could pick up a pencil and I could gradually could write with it. And I got pretty good with it and I kept it up. So a year or two later, I could write reasonably well with my right hand. But to turn that pencil over and use the eraser, very much harder than actually writing. You see, all the kids in kindergarten, I'm still kind of like a kindergartner trying. The number of muscles it takes to turn a pencil over to use the erasers, it's extraordinary what dexterity it takes. And I felt tremendous sympathy for the kids because I'm still there with that. I can write very nicely with my right hand, but it's still very hard to turn the pencil over. So we take the dexterity of our hands for granted a great deal, and the uses of them, not just the dexterity, the kinds of uses of them. We reach. Maybe the behind the specific activities, what our hands do, they reach. They reach, they reach. They reach and grasp. So if reaching is most basic to the hand, grasping is about the first thing it does. And so the mind grasps, the hand grasps. Which came first, the grasping mind or the grasping hand? The Buddhist, I don't know if even Abhidharma goes there. Does it? One of the people who studied Abhidharma. It's mostly, Buddhism is mostly studied the mind, the grasping mind. Well, the grasping mind and the grasping hand are deeply in collusion, shall we say, in some form, right? They encourage each other. But grasping, of course, is not only a harmful clinging. That isn't the only kind of grasping the mind and hand do. There's grasping at mastery in the sense of fluency and skill. Like turning over pencils, you can use the eraser. Forks, computers, sewing. Anyone who's sewn a rakusu knows that there's a great deal of the mastery of the hand and the involvement of the mind and that comes up in a way you don't expect when you start doing a different kind of project like that. A lot of emotional stuff comes up. Strange until you get into it. It's very intimate. So we reach and we grasp and we grasp to hold from harm. We grasp the kid out of the way, road, out of traffic. I almost had an accident. I grasped at my brake pedal because it was a crow. Surely it was a crow there on Todd Road as I was zipping around when there was no traffic, but it didn't move. Crows know to get out of the way. And the closer I got, so I jammed on the brakes, and the ring-tailed pheasant, or ring-neck pheasant, just sat there and looked at me and looked at me and slowly walked off the road. That was no problem. What I didn't know was that there was a speeding police car behind me with his lights going. He didn't have a siren. I was looking at the bird. I wasn't noticing lights way in the distance. So he had. Luckily, there was no other car. He went around me at a tremendous rate while I waited for the bird to cross the road, and we all parted ways happily. So there's a kind of grasping that's very positive, you know, the grasping to hold from harm. But the mind, this mind of ours, starts over and over and over. Into the moment from a perspective of separation. The mind, one of the things the mind has learned is me here, you there. And that's so early learned. And it's operationally true to a considerable extent is true, but we take it as a sort of a complete fact and forget about other aspects of reality. So the mind starts over and over and over from this position of separation, me here, you there, and very often opposition. What is life told us? I'd like a couple more feet between you and me. You know, that's kind of what a life has taught us about a lot of things. Give me a little more space and time here, and then I'll maybe come forward. When we're separate, we think maybe that's, you know, just the way it ought to be. And then the mind gets past that. We see that that's a perspective and not just an absolute reality, that we are separate. And we move toward, often with the hand. The mind reaches, the hand reaches. So these hard working hands reach and bridge. That's just quite a sense what the mind is doing when it says, oh no, it's not just I'm separate and opposed, I'm distinct from and, you know, made of. And we start to remember a wider view. And the hands are a very important piece of that, crucial piece of that. They're reaching out is always, well, either, unless it's an act of pushing away, it's a bridge. Even if it's pushing away, it's a bridge. It reaches from and to. It reaches through space. It moves toward, across the gap. And I read a novel some time ago, and I'd given it to Elska to read, and she said, not apropos of this even, this is a wonderful passage you should read. So I read it again. It's a novel called Ahab's Wife. I don't know if any of you have read it. It's an imagined account of what it would have been like to be Ahab's wife in Nantucket. He happens to have a kind of a latter-day feminist wife. To a degree, right? She's a very awake and thoughtful person. He probably didn't have a wife anyway. But who was Ahab? So this is Ahab's wife while he's off sailing around the world after the Leviathan. She's living her life. And somewhere in the novel, she says, I reach my hands towards the stars. I spread my fingers. She says, to think that I could gather them into my hands, that I could stuff them in my pockets, is folly. It is I myself alive now who reach into the night toward the stars, she says. Their light is on my hands. Their light is in my hands. She says, I cannot call their names, but they're not strangers to me. I know them in my being, and they know me. Reaching toward the stars, in a sense, the mind says you can't reach them. They are way out there, and yet there's an experience, a connection in the reaching itself. The reaching, the bridging is itself an experience of connecting and knowing, even in that case where it's not a visceral knowing. Bridging is a noble work. We have a mind that sees ourselves as separate, and that is what I call a natural limitation. We can call it delusion, and we have to say it's a naturally occurring human delusion, that ignorance and this kind of ignorance or delusion, ignorance of more than that, is a natural event in human life. And there is a kind of practice of accepting that in Zen. It's pointless to fight that reality as a reality. It is reality. So, but then the question is, what are you going to do about that? To accept a reality is then to have the ground from which to do something about it. This isn't accepting what you can't change and then changing what you can. It's saying you can't really change anything until you really know it, until you know it's there, at least not skillfully. You can make changes, but to accept this is a reality of my life, illness, aging, and death, for instance, arthritis that's invaded my hands, accepting this reality, then I can do something. Accepting the reality that my mind has created for many, many years, the story of separation and what it means to me, right? There's this experience of distinctness and of separation, me here, you there. And there's a lifetime of narrative and story that has built on that. And if I accept that as a reality, which means I have to know it, I have to look into it and know it, then I can do something. Then I can do something more skillfully. And there was a bookstore in Northampton when I lived in that area called Beyond Words. It was the Many Rivers bookstore of the area. It was called Beyond Words. But our poem that we recite in the morning service says it is not beyond words. Truth is not beyond words. It's not limited by words, but it's not beyond them. It's in words, too, but can't be fully expressed just in words. And if you think it is fully expressed in words, you're going to come a cropper. You're going to make some terrible mistakes because you'll believe in it beyond what you know. And yet, truth is expressed in words, and there is knowing. The way that hands bridge and reach and touch offers something very deep and important to our way of experiencing our life. Because words bridge to another person. You hear something, and of course, everyone hears something different from everybody else and from what the other person thought they were saying. And something reaches across, and you look the other face to see if there's a responding glint. When the hand reaches and bridges, there's something directly shared. That's different still for the two people. When you hold Lily's hand and Lily holds your hand, your experience of holding Lily in your arms, say, is very vivid. Her experience of being held is vivid, but they're very different, and yet they're very different experiences. One can't happen without the other. And to try to be aware of how it is to be the other person in that kind of exchange is a wonderful and vivid time. Something very intimate happens with the physicality of touch. One of Elska's children, her son, is a very fine potter back in Massachusetts. And he does beautiful work. He does very functional things and things that are barely functional, perhaps. The very tall, elegant vase forms. But he chose clay as his medium as a sculptor and chose functionality because with clay there's nothing between him and it. It's intimate. There's almost no mediating anything. It's just that. And he chose functionality because then another person will have their own experience of holding it. They won't just be looked at on a shelf. So it'll be touch and holding and handling different for the different people. But it will be, there's a deep, deep knowing and connecting that happens body to body, hand to hand. And at that time, our reaching, we can know our reaching as a reaching into intimacy. It's one of the best ways for us to know intimacy. And this is not just intimacy with a person, which is one of the most difficult kinds. There's intimacy with the piece of paper. There's intimacy with the thing we're engaged in. When Thich Nhat Hanh wrote his wonderful account of washing dishes and just washing dishes when you wash dishes, it's about intimacy with what you're doing right now, knowing that the water is warm or cool and enjoying it, being there intimately with it. Then your dishwashing world is much richer than if your mind is somewhere else and you wish you weren't dishwashing. In the experience of intimacy, we're no longer exactly reaching. We have reached. There's connection. There's contact. There's non-separation. And this was a sort of what I felt in the snake. Snake is. The snake, in its own way, it's doing, but it's already completely present as it is. It doesn't have to get there. We're forever getting there. I'm going to be this way tomorrow or later, or I will do these four things today on my list. I need lists, but they're very useful. At the same time, I'm gonna get there, and they increase in some ways the experience of the gap. And then there's bridging. I'm more forever efforting and bridging. It may be pleasant, it may be not, but it's an implicit crossing bridge endlessly. The snake is already there. Now, it doesn't have the ability to make a list. I don't want to give that up. But I want to see that that underneath, buried in that listing and jobs and taking care of and meeting, that there is, I'm not seeing the place where I'm always reaching, efforting, and that there is, so can I find a human way of being like a snake while I'm still being a human with these hands, still reaching, bridging, but in that, we have to find the human way to be like the snake, fully present. We can't wait till we, so to speak, get there. Can we reach as an expression of already being fully present in this moment? The reaching itself is the human version of being the snake. I get this a little bit in Zazen. We're kind of snaky in that sense in Zazen. This mudra is a mudra where the hands are no longer separate. That's a lot of what it's saying. It's called the Hokkaido and the one world, one pure Dharma world mudra. Everything is one, one world. And the cross-legged posture, you also get, when you can do that, you get to knit that together too. It's hard to say which leg is where. They aren't really two separate legs. It may be kind of a little ball of snake, but it's kind of snaky nonetheless in that it's, you're here. The Kinhin posture where you wrap your hand around your thumb and wrap your hand around your hand is an expression of non-harming, of essentially of non-reaching, of contained, but fully present. And when you do Kinhin with a few other, we rarely do it alone. I have done, but it's more commonly the rhythm of a body with another body moving around, two or three or ten, however many, and keeping kind of a space from the other bodies. And it's a slow dance that's you're each one fully present while you're there doing it together. And each one's doing it encourages the other one's doing it. So much so that when your mind says, I wish they'd hurry up, which sometimes happens, you know it's your mind. It's one more chance to say, oh, look at that crabby little mind. You know? Look at that judgmental, critical mind coming up. So the hands that reach and do as already being the person fully present, those I'd call the hands of freedom. So I was thinking of this as the hands of effort and the hands of freedom. Knowing hands. The hands of freedom are the hands of, it's probably one of my, maybe my all-time favorite koan is, what does the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with 1,000 hands and eyes? Because, you know, there's a version of Kuan Yin that has two hands. There's one with, maybe holds a vase to pour pure water, or holds a gem, a wish-fulfilling gem or something like that. Then there's four hands and 8 and 12 and 24. And if you get as far as, let's say, a statue of a Kuan Yin with up to maybe 24 hands, each hand is holding an implement. There's tiny little implements that those little hands hold of benefit for the world. When you get to the Kuan Yin of 1,000 hands, she isn't holding anything in those hands anymore. It's just hands. But each hand has an eye in it. Each of the hands. 1,000 hands and eyes. Every hand has an eye in it. Well, in the koan, the koan goes on, the answer is... These are just two Zen monks talking to each other, two Dharma brothers. So the one says, what does the Bodhisattva of great compassion do with 1,000 hands and eyes? And the answer is, it's like someone reaching behind their head for a pillow in the night. You know, you don't even have to open your eyes. You half wake up and you reach for the pillow, your hand finds the pillow and puts it there. You don't stop and think about that. In our own, this morning, before breakfast, the tea kettle was this hatu patu, this hot water pot, was set up, and it wasn't pumping. And so someone said to me, well, should it have a tube? And I couldn't remember, because, you know, sometimes there's a tube that you have to get that to pump the water, but I had to go over to it with my hands and take the lid off and put the lid on and then go like this, and suddenly it worked. Because my hands knew. My hands knew how to make that thing work. My hands, I couldn't remember with my head whether it had a tube or not. Because sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But my hands knew that this one works just like this. It's more mundane, but it's like reaching for a pillow in the night. The hand knows. The hand has a knowledge already in it. And so the koan goes on from there. That image is wonderful in itself, and you can go a long ways with what does it mean? And that's that part of this koan. What does it mean to say that if you have 1,000 hands, if you're the bodhisattva of great compassion, your action of those hands, of all 1,000 hands, myriad, endless hands, is like reaching for a pillow in the night. It's like your hands knowing how to make the teapot work. That means that the bodhisattva of great compassion is not reaching out toward, but is already there. Already, the hands already know. The hands are already fully engaged. Their hands are already present. The hand is already, you didn't notice it, but it's already there. Right? The hand there isn't a gap to reach across. It's just a natural, complete movement. So in the koan, goes on, and so the first one asks about the bodhisattva of compassion and his 1,000 hands and eyes, and the answer is like reaching behind your head with a pillow in the night. And the other one says, I understand. And his Dharma brother isn't so sure he likes I understand. So he says, well, how do you understand? And the answer says, all over the body are hands and eyes. Every cell, every sense is hands and eyes. Isn't that wonderful? Everything, every bit of this wonderful organ called the skin, is every bit of that is the hands and eyes already completely present and engaged. Dharma brother says, well, you've said quite a bit there, but you've only said 80% of it. You've got most of it, but that's not the whole of it. Well, what do you say, older brother? He says. And he says, throughout the body are hands and eyes. Everything that's going on is hands and eyes. When we talked yesterday, I talk with my hands. This one talks with her whole body. We were sitting and talking, and I didn't care what she was saying or I was saying. At some point, I was just watching her body. I did care, but I was just watching her body. It was the most amazing thing. I did care. But I go like this. Whole torso body. You're going to have to give a talk sometime. Now you'll be shy about it. But whole body is engaged. Throughout the body is the expression of life happening. Throughout the body, hands and eyes. The eye and the hand aren't separate, and they are complete. This is the bodhisattva of compassion's experience. Reaching out with hands of clarity, every hand and eye, the seeing and the touching are not separate. You know, actually, what I said this morning was, let me see about the teapot. And I reached over with my hands. And they have little eyes in their fingertips that my eyes didn't have. Reaching out hands and eyes, reaching out from all different cells of the body, all of ourself and our mind and our heart, reaching out, not over a gap, already present, already here, and participating. Maybe that's what the snake is doing. The snake is participating. Kuan Yin Avalokiteshvara is participating, already present. Not only the palms of hands, the whole body. Not only covered with eyes and hands, but filled with hands and eyes. In the whole world, there's nothing that is not the hands and eyes. And most of the time, we work with these hands that reach out and bridge. And if we pay attention to the connecting that happens at the end and kind of draw that sort of rainbow back over the bridge to know that, in fact, we've been doing that engagement the whole time. It's not just at the end point. The whole time is the act of the engagement. The whole time is the act of caring about what's going to happen. The whole time is the time of accepting that the plate slipped out of the hand and is scooting across the air to the floor where it's going to break into many pieces. It's already happening. When we can live that way, then we're not efforting. Then it's a natural activity. It's still sweat, but the sweat is just part of that same natural activity. My dream snake still has those human problems that lead it to get stuck up under an aquarium instead of drinking from the natural pool, right? It gets into tight places. And we need each other to say, oh, here, let me help you back out into your natural world. Those were hands that reached out to the snake when the snake was in trouble. So even the snake has this wonderful sense of natural wisdom, and I saw this great sense of relief. The snake can get into trouble too. Constantly giving and exchanging a thousand hands and eyes like snakes. So. Empty hands. When we published Opening the Hand of Thought in the early 90s, it was in a Penguin paperback, and you don't have any control over the cover. So the cover, but we were asked, but the editor at Penguin was very kind. He showed it to us. He gave us, you know, not, we didn't have the right to reject it, but he wanted us to approve it. And he showed us this cover. It was a little bit new age. It was kind of nice as a hand and all these kind of sparkly little foggy things whooshing out from it into the gray fog. It was, I thought it was, yeah. And then I sent it, faxed it over to Japan to Uchiyama Roshi was dead by then. He would have liked it because what Tom Wright, the other translator, said was that when Uchiyama Roshi would talk with his hands, give talks about opening the hand of thought, his great image, he held his hands like this. Thoughts are heavy. They fall down. These thoughts were light and flew out. But Uchiyama Roshi's thoughts were heavy little things that went down and hit the ground. So the hands have to go like this and the hands have to go like that. Empty and full. That's it. That's all I have to say. Does anyone else have any